it's going to bleed into our social fabric. We're just not aware, and perhaps with our documentary, people will become more aware that it will touch their lives. It's just that how quickly it'll touch their lives, I can't say. It may not be their life, but it'll be the life of their offspring. It'll be the life of future generations, but it's coming. Change is coming.
That's Michelle Battle Fisher talking about transhumanism, and you're listening to the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. This is the show where we get to go deep and long form using the lenses of risk and uncertainty to explore all kinds of fascinating topics, whether they may be big picture issues of the day or talking to risk takers or to discuss resilience. We hope that these conversations are informative and entertaining. And today we have a conversation that encompasses technology, health, innovation, and of course, risk and uncertainty. And it's a conversation that raises some very challenging and interesting questions around personal freedom versus public protection, ethics, and a whole lot more. My guest is Michelle Battle Fisher. And if that is a familiar name to you, that's probably because I had Michelle on as a guest in episode 20, and you should check that out if you haven't yet done so. Michelle is a respected systems theorist, bioethicist, and futurist, and she is an adjunct professor at Wright State University, which is in Ohio in the United States. She is also the co-producer of an upcoming documentary called Transhuman, and if that rings a bell, it may also be because I had Ford Fisher, the other co-producer of that documentary, on the All Things Risk podcast in episode 36. And if you listen to that episode, you will know that transhumanism is this belief or theory that through technology, humans can evolve beyond our physical and mental limitations. So it encompasses things like biohacking, genetic engineering, life extension, some very interesting technologies that are amazing and seemingly around the corner, so we need to be prepared. Transhumanism also raises all kinds of questions around societal risks and uncertainties, risks to the practitioners of some of these technologies, ethics, personal freedoms, and other areas that we get into in this fascinating conversation with Michelle. We talk about innovation and science. We ask the question about how much should some of these technologies be regulated. And that coincides with an interesting other side of the coin, which is around personal freedom. So whose body is it anyway? If I want to hack my body, why should anyone stop me? We discuss unexpected consequences. We talk about transhumanism and inequality and a whole lot more. This was a fabulous conversation. It really opened up my eyes to a number of the different aspects of the topic. And I think Michelle is a great addition to that Transhuman documentary that I've mentioned and you can check out in the show notes that's upcoming. At any rate, let's get into it. Here's Michelle Battle Fisher on transhumanism. Enjoy. Michelle, welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. It's a pleasure to have you back on the show. You're my second repeat guest, so welcome back.
Oh, I am very special. Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to come back. You were just a pleasure to speak with before, and I have some exciting new directions that my work is taking, so I'm looking forward to talking about it with your listeners.
Well, we'll get into that. And most notably, you've been working with another past guest of mine, Ford Fisher, on a documentary on transhumanism. And we'll dive into that. For people, though, that didn't catch episode 20, where you were my guest the first time around, you are a systems thinker or systems theorist, and it would be useful to just give a very quick synopsis of what you've done and what you do for my listeners.
Oh, certainly. And I want to tell the listeners, my name is Battle Fisher and Ford Fisher. We are no relation. Strangely enough, it's a really weird world. Yes, I am a systems theorist. That's primarily what I'm known as. And I've really been working in the area of health policy and public health in particular. And so what's important to understand with public health is that we're looking at health, health status as a collective. Not that we're not interested in the clinical perspective of the individual patient, mm-hmm. but from a systems perspective, we are all interconnected. And so the health status of one affects the health status of communities, of larger networks, of larger clusters. And so that's really the direction or the perspective that I take mm-hmm. in trying to dissect, you know, why people are sick. You know, I mean, it's ethical, it's moral, it's just, these are huge concerns that we share as a society. And the perspective that I'm taking is everything that I see is a system. Mm-hmm. Everything is a physiological system. The physiological system is connected to the social system, which is connected to the political system. And that is really where I have such a wonderful comfort in looking at the world around me. So back to what systems is, again, noting that everything in the world is interconnected in some way. Now, everything in the world is connected, but it's nonsensical for me to try to speak in such grandiose or mm-hmm. grand terms. And so we do place a priori or predetermined boundaries on those systems. And so I may be interested in, say, the Somali refugees in Minnesota. There's mm-hmm. presently a measles outbreak, which is something individuals like measles has come back. There, you know, there's a movement of not vaccinating optimally. There's something called herd immunity, which means that we need to be able to vaccinate. And if I believe correctly, about 98% of a population, in order for that population to rid of the disease that we are interested in. But we are going below that threshold. So when we're going below that threshold, if we have entire communities that are experiencing a malady that we didn't previously have to be concerned, well, that is going to go beyond that particular community. It's going to trickle out into the larger community and into, hopefully discussions on how we really need to be approaching health as a collective. And it's those individual decisions, it is collective decisions that all come together as a system mm-hmm. and they feed back to each other. And this is, as you can see, I'm just very committed and very excited about looking at the world in this way.
Yeah, it's it is a very useful way of making sense of complex phenomena. And I guess, you know, very simplistic terms to break down, you could think about like a bicycle as a system, right? Could I say that? So you got the pedals and the chain and the wheels and the, you know, the frame and all the different parts are working together. And if you think about, it's very hard to isolate the bicycle are the pedals. No, there's more to it than that. And if you get the wrong pedals, you can't move the bicycle. Is that fair? Did I just insult your entire your entire discipline?
No, of course you didn't insult when you're bringing it away from the physics and away from the mm-hmm. physical states of systems. I am working in the messiness of the social system. Mm-hmm. Individuals in the world are not predictable. As much as economists want to say that we are rational mm-hmm. actors, we are far from rational. We have autonomy. We have the ability to act in our own self-interest. We also have the ability, if without coercion, to act in the interest of those we care about and are closest to us. So, you know, the decisions of one person, well, we might not feel it immediately. It will begin to create a ripple in a system. If you could think of that ripple, of when individuals used to may have played with, you know, the cans and the string and how everyone is connected. I'm not speaking about the fact that, you know, individuals at the end probably just didn't have any idea what the first person said. But there is an energy that's going to go across those lines, and then systems we can call those ties or bridges. And so we're rippling out to the first, and then we're rippling out to the second, and it all will feed back to the first. So it's the beauty of the circular, is the beauty of what we call small world, which means that, you know, we are connected very closely, though we may not have this physical vicinity. It's really amazing how I have come across individuals who are in my field or have interest in my field, and I'm probably only a few steps away from these individuals, between people that I know, then they know, and then I'm connected to them. We don't always realize what those connections are, but they're there, and some will become apparent to us, and some we pretty much don't even care about. But when we're talking about something like a measles outbreak, I think a community should be concerned.
Yeah, we were talking about this when just before we kicked off, and you know, there's this tension between the individual and individuals' rights, and you know, in a very libertarian sense, well, I can do whatever, and we'll get into this in a moment with transhumanism, but yeah, I can do whatever I want with my body, and that might mean also not vaccinating myself or not vaccinating my children. But, you know, if you think about it from a systems perspective, well, yeah, but then that creates a wider problem for the rest of society. So, you know, you can only take that that individual argument quite possibly only so far.
If every anti-vaxxer could have their own island where they can pass disease among themselves, then it may not be of issue because they've made that decision. But children, they do not hold their own autonomy. And in addition, you know, this is something that policies and laws, administrative laws, when they're talking more of, you've heard of nanny state.
Yes.
Kind of this, oh, yes. I hate that term, but the paternalism that we speak of, that there are situations in society that it's believed that we cannot necessarily leave it up to the individual to act only in their self-interest, because it is not only their self-interest becomes the reality that's lived also by the collective around them. So, you know, it's a grand discussion, people are going to fall on different ends of the continuum. But, you know, I chose public health and medicine as my career, so you probably can get a sense of where I might fall, but we're not all in agreement.
No, and you know, I think there are all kinds of people I think who listen to this podcast, and people of different perspectives. So, you know, I'm very interested in bringing forward different different perspectives. But you know, having said that, systems thinking can really, as you well know, can really bring out a number of things that we were on last time. We talked about unintended consequences and known unknowns and things like this. And
unknown and unknowns.
Systems thinking can help us, I think, understand some of those things a little bit better, perhaps. But at any rate, I don't want to digress too much on systems thinking, because I think you could probably discuss it for hours. So I want to talk about transhumanism, and I want to, first of all, just understand, you got involved in Ford Fisher's project, this documentary on transhumanism, and I'm just curious where and how that interest came about.
Interesting enough, I started appearing on podcasts that were more of the futurism, mm-hmm. and that was just a really curious jump that I made, because in systems, we also are very interested in the future configuration of systems, because our systems are not static. If they were, then it'd be very easy to fix them. But the fact is, systems continue to change. Physiological systems continue to change. Social systems continue to change. And so, you know, I was like, well, certainly it's with a discussion of policy and ethics and systems. In my book, I was just really bringing home to this point that though I'm speaking of perhaps a policy right now, we are living under these policies. And while we're living with these policies, our lives are changing, which means that the system is changing for good or for worse. That system will change. Mm-hmm. So, and with policy, we want things to change. That's the reason why we put policies and laws into place. Though we're aware that policies are not always successful. You can have the best policy out there, but if it isn't adopted by the society which or the community that is being targeted, then it's policy on paper. And then we have to look at how things are actually working. And that's why policymakers hopefully are going to make, you know, informed decisions and not jump the gun and develop healthcare bills in a week. But I digress. I digress.
Yeah, and this podcast is going to go out in, I don't know, 7 or 8 weeks from now. So who knows what we're talking about the future?
Who knows
what will happen by then?
Who knows? We may have United States. We may have 3 or 4 new versions of a health bill, but we'll just have to see.
I'm just kind of hoping that you guys just hold it together and that there will still be a United States or a world in 7 or 8 weeks.
Shh, we're not talking about that.
Yes.
But back to the transhumanism. I did start appearing as a guest on on those podcasts, and it really started with Robot Overlords. Mm-hmm. Mike Johnston, that's his baby. And I was kind of talking about systems, and I was really still coming from the perspective of looking at not just the mechanics, but also the social mechanics of people living in communities and dealing with health. Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, I think we can even push that a little bit more, because there's this thing called transhumanism, and there's also this discussion of the failings of the medical community or conventional medicine to live up to its grand promises that we're going to live, you know, healthy, productive lives. So let's talk about transhumanism. Mm. And I'm saying, goodness, I actually never thought of that connection before. And then that led to going on to another transhumanism podcast. And then, so it's sort of built up. And Ford Fisher had been a guest on Robot Overlords.
Yes.
And I told Mike, I was like, you know what, we need to work on this, you know, network connection that you are just one step away from Ford, and I need to talk to him. And so we had some discussions, and he brought me on as a producer. So I've been kind of the academic head, and he is the person who has really the filmmaking and the journalistic and news experience. But I'm bringing in kind of the nerdy, you know, some might say a little dry, but I would like to say that I try to make that dry, as you said the last podcast, nutrient rich.
Yes.
And people want to consume it. And I thought this was just a wonderful avenue with the documentary to do that.
That's great. Before we dive in too much, what for people that are just tuning in for the first time and have just only recently heard of or have never heard of transhumanism, what is it? Can you explain it to folks?
Yeah, well, let me just put it this way. Our understanding of what human is in flux. Mm-hmm. Now, we always have looked at our bodies as something that is adaptive, that has evolved. There may be some, you know, discussion of how we evolved, but we have changed and we've adapted to our environments. We've also adapted to this, not just the physical environments around us, but also the social environments. And so there is an element of society that really purports that we have this physical body that is imperfect in the fact that we are still being affected by illness. We still mm-hmm. are not living to our highest potential physiologically or physically. And so there are individuals in this transhumanist movement who are saying that we have the ability with technology to radically modify our bodies. Mm. Completely radically change them. And what do I mean by radically changed? This means that there's the belief in this community of transhumanism that conventional medicine has not gone far enough. Clinical medicine has not fully grasped the potential of how far the body can go. Hmm. And I love for Fisher's kind of like conceptualization of transhumanism, that they want to go beyond human.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really framing us as we're just a work in progress, but some of us are really dissatisfied with, you know, the state of that progress or the speed of that progress. And so in transhumanism, there are those who are transhumanists who are said to be followers of this belief. And then there are, did I say, yes, and then there's transhumanism, which is the movement. But again, they want to radically enhance, but this is a risk and uncertainty podcast. So there is no other topic that I can think of right now that isn't wrought with uncertainty or
yes.
risk and uncertainty.
Yes.
Think about
let's,
this.
Yes. Yeah, no, I was a couple of things just as you were speaking just popped to mind before we get into the risk and uncertainty part, because you know there are quite a few, but the comment about, you know, the medical establishment mm-hmm. and hasn't gone far enough, and that to me is really interesting, because and I'm curious about your take on this, because we seem to be in this space where the we're afflicted by, and so putting aside the, you know, measles outbreaks for a mm-hmm. moment, but you know, where lifestyle diseases are really, in at least in Western countries, the main thing, whether that's heart disease or diabetes or
that is, you know, correct. Yes,
and
that is the case.
And the, you know, the medical establishment or pharmaceutical companies or whatever, you know, there's the money is in treating lifestyle diseases, and so we as a society, you know, have this sort of place of stasis in terms of health, because, you know, we're getting sold these these pharmaceuticals that just help us live with whether it's heart disease or diabetes or whatever, so I can understand where that comes from in terms of, well, you know, we have to really, you know, push the boundaries here and move beyond that. So I don't know what your take is on that. Mine would be, yes, let's definitely push the boundaries, and I fully can understand the frustrations with the medical establishment. But there's also a piece around, well, we also just have to get the basics right in terms of, you know, eating right and exercising and, you know, doing all those things too. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but it's an interesting take on the topic.
No, I think that is a grand point to bring up. It is not only about the physiology or deterioration of our bodies. There is an element in many cases of a personal lifestyle as to why that body is being afflicted. From what I can tell, there is less discussion within transhumanism about that lifestyle component. Mm-hmm. A lot that I have come across in the production of the documentary and in my discussions with transhumanists and academics who are interested in this is transhumanism is equated with what we call body hacking. Mm-hmm. And body hacking is the act of inserting the radical technology into our bodies. Okay, so this could be a sensor, something as simple as a sensor that could perhaps, you know, open a garage door. And if that's something that's interesting to a person that they want to be hacked and put a sensor into their arm, mm-hmm. so they can open their garage door, fine. But it's also gone as far as there is a scientist who has grown an ear and he has implanted that ear on his arm, and he is interested in seeing if he can develop this hyper sense of hearing.
Wow.
With this ear. I mean, this may sound like science fiction,
yes,
to some, but this is what transhumanism, they are pushing boundaries.
Yes. Yes.
But with that ear, and again, I can't speak to what this person is hearing with that ear, or whether he has the capability. But there also brings this issue of privacy. You can't turn off that ear. You know, so is there a point where,
right,
you know, you can't say, well, now I'm going to turn that off so if I'm overhearing, you know, people's discussions on a bus. I mean, do you really want to have that hyper sense to be able to invade other people's space? But the framework that you tend to hear about transhumanism is this is a individual decision that they are hacking their bodies.
Yes.
In order to elevate their humanness.
Right.
And when everybody else comes on board, then we'll have a community of cyborgs or people who are hacked. Mm-hmm. And then humanity will be elevated because individuals who have made individual decisions to have their bodies change so radically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when I spoke to Ford, he gave a very good breakdown of the different elements of transhumanism, and so things like what you're talking about, you know, super intelligence or lifestyle, life extension, and also genetic engineering. So, which gets into the whole, you know, designer babies type CRISPR. Of CRISPR and things like
and
this.
CRISPR, yes. I mean, there's talk with transhumanists that CRISPR is the ability to change the genome, mm-hmm. individual genomes, in order to fight diseases. Mm-hmm. The first question would be disease is just not a umbrella term that says we're going to attack disease. Mm. And the complication of genetics is that we've had such a difficult time getting a blueprint. It's taken decades and decades and decades. Will we ever be to the point where we can have a simple test that will, you know, modify us genetically in mm-hmm. order to eliminate disease? And again, you know, are we eliminating cancer? We haven't been, you know, fully successful with conventional medicine, but
yes.
we also need to understand on the flip side that if we genetically modify ourselves, there is no going back to where we were before. Mm-hmm. And for transhumanism, it's like, well, we don't want to go back because that wasn't great for mm-hmm. us. Mm-hmm. We were still dying. We were still living in an unsatisfactory way. To transhumanists, dying is an inconvenience. It is unnecessary. And death needs to be eliminated.
When I spoke to Ford and we talked about Zoltan Isfahan, who's the head of the Transhumanist Party in the United States, and I asked, well, you know, isn't death what gives meaning to life? I think, you know, Zoltan's response and Ford, made the same thing as well. Not necessarily. No,
right.
You know, why does it have to be that way? Which is, you know, let's push the boundaries, right?
Right. Because we have not lived within that reality of there not being death.
Yes.
Yeah. But my being in public health and in this medicine is that we are talking about extension of life to a hopefully peaceful end. And we in the transhumanist community, I probably would be defined as a health spanner, which means that there is going to be an end. Yes, we might want to push that end farther, because we talk about demography, we talk about life tables, we talk about the fact that life expectancies in, say, African American communities or Native American communities are abysmal, or for instance, Kentucky. I don't know if you've ever been to Kentucky, because you're from Canada, but Kentucky is home to five counties that unceremoniously can say that their children will not live longer than their parents.
Wow.
Five counties in that one state. And so this is certainly not something that is only a United States problem. Again, you're saying I'm from the United States. This is an issue of defining what our lives should be defined as. And so I'm probably coming from transhumanist saying, well, you know, so where is this meaning of the quality of our lives? You know, will we have enough resources to be able to sustain a population that never dies?
Right.
Will there be a decision that we have enough individuals that we do not need to procreate anymore? And so that is then a decision that could be, you know, morally reprehensible to some individuals.
Yes.
You know, who's to make that decision that this sector may live indefinitely and then another sector may just die out?
That creates all kinds of ethical questions. And now, just to be clear, this, a lot of these technologies are in their very infant stages. So when we talk about, you know, life extension and even genetic engineering and all of this stuff, body hacking, even. I had a guest, Solomon Baugh, who's a Paralympian here in the UK. He's a sprinter. He's blind, or he's partially blind, he is actually kind of submitting himself to some tests or experiments to see about, you know, treating that that blindness. And I don't know all of the details, but, you know, for somebody in his condition, you know, this is great, because, you know, potentially I have a way that I can see, or, you know, deaf people could hear, or, you know, this kind of thing. But to be clear, you know, a lot, and the conversation with Ford really bore that out, that these technologies are very, very nascent. So we're nowhere near, you know, living forever or life extension or any of this stuff. We're in the very early stages. Having said that, some of the stuff that Ford described and that's possible, 5 or 10 years ago, you'd think, wow, that's amazing. So one story that Ford gave was this computer imaging based on someone's thoughts. So they're thinking about something, and then, you know, the computer would kind of print a picture or, you know, draw a picture, and it was blurry, and it was, you know, the color palette was right, but it was very difficult to distinguish anything else. But even that, 10 years ago, you would say, wow, this is scary. Not scary, but not just scary, but this is amazing. This
scary,
is both,
scary.
This is scary and amazing, right?
Yes, the technology can so rapidly change.
Yes.
The problem is, and I'm not going to say the problem, but, you know, it needs to be considered, though technology changes, who are going to be the recipients of those technologies. Mm-hmm. Will this be a technology that will be openly available to everyone, or will it remain those who have special access to those technologies?
Yes.
And so we do need to honestly discuss whether we already have inequalities, mm-hmm. perhaps, but then we may develop a heightened inequality.
We not only have inequalities, but we have, you know, greater inequalities now than we did 30 years ago in Western societies.
So is this a movement that is going to amplify inequality, or will it be technology that will make individuals more equal as far as their humanness?
And also a question might be, is that, you know, is inequality necessarily a bad thing?
We haven't been successful in eradicating it, because it's that moving target. We feel that we've made progress in one area, and then but that's systems.
Yes.
It's like we're moving forward, and then we're going to have those backward feedbacks, where we're going to regress, and then we'll move forward a little, and then we'll feed back, and then we'll have those positive and negative feedbacks to amplify and retract, amplify change, and then control and retract change. Because what we also want to avoid is chaos, uncontrollable chaos in our systems. We still have to have some way of feeling that we are in control of our systems. Because at this point, transhumanism is off of the radar. And what I mean by off the radar, it's not regulated. They are individuals, and we call them grinders, and they may not even like that label, but grinders are individuals that will hack themselves.
Right.
Say they will hack their friend with a sensor.
Right.
And this is done without anesthesia. It's done without the precautions that we require. Ethically in medicine. And so these individuals are taking not only the risks of the future, whether this will work, but they're also taking clinical risks, whether they will inadvertently cause more damage than, you know, the perceived benefit that they're seeking.
So some would argue that, you know, don't we need that, though? Don't we need people that are willing to, you know, take some of those risks and try these things to be able to make any progress?
We've always had people who've taken risks. You know, the scientific community, they are very resistant to new radical ideas because they want to say, has this been replicated? And that is good science. But it can also silence innovations that are contrary to the present scientific dogma.
Right.
And it doesn't have the ability to, percolate and get traction. So there's certainly something to be said that, you know, science may certainly not be, it is not open to innovation. As some of us might like, but there also is the protection of subjects, human subjects protection.
Yes.
There's also the ability to regulate these technologies to protect consumers. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm going to call them consumers because this is a product that is created to give them a commercial benefit. Okay, so these are consumers. But these individuals are saying, we don't want to wait for that. And if we did, we would already be off of this earth.
Yeah.
So we want to be the first. We have to be the pioneers of this because the scientific community, the medical community will not take this risk. And so they may, though they are individually hacking themselves, it still can be said that they still have this grand belief that it will help future generations, that they will live longer. But they will say that they wouldn't mind if they're the ones that are going to be here a little longer, and it's not going to be a benefit reaped by only their children or their children's children. They want to also affect themselves now as much as they can push that post-humanist or radically modifying their own bodies. Now, society hasn't had too much concern with individuals, say, who are amputees, because there is also this idea in our society that horrible things happen to people, and the medical, medicine is there in order to heal. But in transhumanism, if a person has an appendage that is functionally working according to clinical medicine, there's nothing wrong with it. The person is still able to be mobile, still able to walk. Is it acceptable for that person to modify above and beyond that appendage, which was already working according to our accepted definition of being healthy and being well? There's a father that we have interviewed for the documentary, and he's known as Cyborg Dad. And the really curious discussion of this man, and this, it's just a fascinating story, is that he is fighting for a relationship with his children. He is no longer with the children's mother, and we all know once that happens, then there has to be some type of declaration of who has the children. But the mother in court documents has said that he is a cyborg, and he has no, in her opinion, he has no sense of taming the risks that he will take with his body, and in doing so will that in turn harm the children. And he's like, I want to hack my arms, I want to hack my legs, because I want to be able to have legs that will withstand injury. But that mother is saying, well, we don't know whether that will work. And number two, we don't know, whether you will, live or die.
So we're in this kind of Wild West environment with some of these technologies, aren't we?
And yes, we certainly are. And you know what? If they found a way with his innovation that my children would be able to say, there'll be no more broken legs because Cyborg Dad and these transhumanists found this innovation that would prevent broken legs and broken bones, then our social discussion is going to be completely different. But right now, it is really making us question how far we as a society are willing to go to go beyond this definition of human.
Yes.
Again, we change. There are some things that we now accept much more easily now that prior generation was like, that's blasphemy. We're not going to discuss it. It's something that we'll never accept. And now it is more acceptable. So this could be something that the transhumanists are able to test out for the rest of us, and then it'll be just a foregone conclusion that humanity is going to reap the benefits of their risk-taking.
That's very possible. At the same time, you know, as a systems theorist, you know, we might find, okay, just to go on this, you know, no broken legs example. you know, okay, I have these, you know, these transhuman legs now, and they're made of titanium or whatever. My legs won't be broken. So yeah, then I'm going to start jumping off of buildings or become a parkour and all of a sudden, you know, the incidence of broken arms goes up because people start to, there's all kinds of unintended consequences.
Brilliant.
Right?
Ben, that's brilliant. This is the other thing. We are only hacking elements of our bodies. Mm-hmm. The body is the most complicated physical system that we can imagine. Mm-hmm. You change one thing, it's going to be connected to something else. So we don't know what effect that's going to have on other bodily systems. Mm-hmm. And the other issue is, will the body reject it? I mean, individuals who have, organ donation, they're on, anti-rejection drugs for the rest of their lives while they've had that organ. Mm-hmm. Will the body say that, This was never supposed to be here. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to make sure that you are aware that you need to get this out. So it's going to, you know, the bodies may just fight against it. So if there's any way that they can find a way to guarantee with, of course, not 100% certainty, but an amount of certainty that we would be acceptable to take on the risks, then the hacking will be something, as I said, they're going to be applauding. Mm-hmm. My reservation is, how far do we have to continue to hack our bodies? And you said this. It's like, well, what about the arms? And then it's the legs. Do we then have to hack our brains? Do we then hack, put sensors everywhere? Is it necessary to have a sensor to open your garage? Probably not. But it is a part of this grand, this larger picture, that if this is possible by opening the garage door, just imagine what could be possible with sensors to be able to maybe sense injury. You know, and again, they want to get rid of injury, but you know, they may say that that's a intermediary step. Then the body can sense. Then we can have sensors that will maybe, I don't know, combat apoptosis, where the cancer cells are dividing out of control, and metastasis. Can it then attack that? But we have so many diseases, we have so many illnesses, that it's unfathomable that we, in my opinion, can have technologies that can correct all of them. I think that the one direction that has the most promise in doing that would be the genetic modifications like CRISPR and radically changing the genome. But again, once you change the genome, we're used to doing medical procedures that are affecting that patient. Not necessarily, we're not accepting technologies that it will then be passed on to future generations, because then that future generation had no decision in inheriting that genetic modification. Someone could say that we have genetic diseases that are passed. Yes, we do. But we're talking about on a larger scale. If the entire humankind had their entire genome changed, then future generations would then have to live with that genome change. Did they have a choice in? Did they have a choice in that? Right. No, they would not have had a choice in that offering. Mm-hmm. And to transhumanists is that if we can get this right, then that's great. But I'm saying, what if we don't get it right? Mm-hmm. There could be no going back.
Right. And it's a, kind of classic precautionary principle type of problem, whereby, the effects are irreversible. So should we take on the risk? It's a very interesting risk discussion, because mm-hmm. it's the same with, environmental change, right? You change something, and if there's no going back, then, well, should we even be playing around with, with something that could be potentially, damaging to the environment forever. One of the thoughts that also came to mind as you were describing the whole concept of disease, right? So we have, I think, and similarly, the whole system around organ rejection and stuff like this. Mm-hmm. We have this belief, I think. I think I'm not talking about just general beliefs, that there's healthy and there's unhealthy, and there's disease and there's mm-hmm. lack of disease. And the Chinese medicine, for instance, is different. It's sort of there are states of wellness and unwellness. You're never, what is healthy? I mean, is it healthy enough to be able to get up in the morning and work at a computer? Or is it healthy enough to run a marathon? Or, what is health, generally speaking? And mm-hmm. when you start to kind of hack at, this condition and then that condition and that condition, you don't know what you could be doing if you don't think about your whole body as a system.
The whole darn body is a system. And don't we get frustrated when the battery in our fire, like our smoke detector goes off?
Sure.
And you're like, darn, I need another Duracell. That's not a plug for Duracell. We put another battery in. How do we keep track of malfunctions or making sure that these hacks, continue to function?
Right.
And do we have to extract them? What happens if something goes awry and then that hack has to be extracted because it causes more harm than benefit
so
to them?
I guess as a systems thinker, do you think that there are ways to develop tools and kind of techniques to kind of monitor the overall, the overall system and how it's working, as people start to tinker with their bodies? Do you think there could be some complementarity here?
Using the toolkit that I would have, which would mean that there is documentation, that there's already a system that I can clearly understand, that I can clearly map. This is a rogue system. We call them dark networks. Mm-hmm. These are networks that are under the radar. And I am unaware at this point, with the exception of hackers who are extremely vocal with their hacking, mm-hmm. to be able to understand
what's going on.
What is happening with them. And the very thing that transhumanists do not want is they don't want it to go into traditional regulation.
Right.
Because if it did, then that system would be able to truncate what they're trying to do. And they feel it's going to be, squashing the possible innovation. Because the only way this is going to be innovative is if it stays within this dark network. And again, networks are individuals who have a common connection or a common goal. And their goal, as I said, is to become post-human. But if you bring FDA or Food and Drug Administration in the United States, you bring them in?
Right.
To heck, they're going to be like, now there's no, we need 5 years of clinical tests to decide whether this can go to market. And then 5 years is pretty fast. I probably should have said 10 or more years before it is deemed safe for the consumption by that country or by that community. And they're like, no way.
No.
This is what we're doing. And now you can see how foolish you were to not take this risk.
Yes.
So, Gil, I think it's coming from the outside. I do not label myself as a transhumanist. Mm-hmm. As a systems person, I'm really comfortable in calling myself a futurist because systems change, and mm-hmm. I'm always looking ahead, seeing how things are connecting and then falling apart and coming back together again. But this transhumanist movement, it is really showing how if you can find individuals with this common goal, and you know, and sociologically, because it is seen as fringe by the larger society, mm-hmm. they have had this extraordinary ability to cluster together and hold tight to this focus that we are going to hack each other, and then the outside community will see how they should adopt what we have done to ourselves. Yeah. They are going to be the physical representation that this is what human can be. And it's not, for them, it should not be science fiction. Yeah. If individuals are fortunate enough to watch our documentary, you're just like, are these things happening? Yes. Well, yes, these things are happening, but it's not being... It's not happening where you may have the ability to know about it.
Well, it strikes me that we need to really accelerate our understanding of what's going on in this whole space, because the technology is going to move, you know, very, very quickly before we know it. There are all kinds of amazing and scary things that are out there. So we need to start having these types of conversations around it. And, you know, and I can sympathize with somebody who wants to, you know, innovate, and then, you know, the FDA or whoever comes in and says, you have to wait 5 or 10 years or whatever. I mean, I can totally understand the frustration if you're trying to do something new. But at the same time, we need to be able to strike, it seems to me, some type of balance with regard to some of the unintended consequences and bigger societal risks, which I'd like to maybe dive into a little bit more if you've got some more thoughts on some of the
risks associated. There's there's no societal risk with their transhumanism, with their hacking. The risk is within their bodies.
Right.
Well, maybe the beneficiaries of that risk may be those closest to them, but they're saying that this is my body, which will be an example to the rest of you.
Sure.
So we're not to a point where society should say that we are being affected by all of these people who have hacked themselves.
Sure.
I did mention the cyborg debt, but that mm-hmm. really is more from a legal perspective.
Sure.
But they're vessels, you know, as if they are sitting with a ball of clay on that spinning, on that wheel, and using their bodies to transform it.
Well,
and it was like, now you see what you could have done. Now, I think the biggest, more obvious societal risk, and I can't speak to AI like mm-hmm. other experts might be able to, but who is to define what the threshold is to what's intelligent? Also, how do we define, how do we have the assurance that the super intelligence, the AI, will always act in our interest? Mm-hmm. Who's to say that AI will then work within some rogue interest, that's what I meant to say, that will then say, oh my goodness, that was an unintended consequence that we now were unaware was even going to happen.
Sure.
The genetic discussion we were having before, there's a risk societally if that actually happens, if we don't get it right.
Yeah, I guess what I was thinking about was if some of these things are happening in, you know, sort of dark networks, and there's some kind of great innovation that comes out, and it would be great because it could, I don't know, it could cure a disease, it could make blind people see, it could, you know, whatever, that could have some wonderful societal benefits. I guess what I also expressed this question, where I asked this question of Ford when we spoke, was, well, what about, you know, black market transhumanism? So if you go from dark network to, you know, you're not potentially not that far away from, you know, black market transhumanism, so that, I don't know, maybe that the people that want to be, that want the designer babies, or that, that want to, you know, be able to run, you know, 100 meters in less than 9.5 seconds, or whatever, the people that can, you know, that can pay for these technologies, start to create a, instead of just societal benefits, you've got people that are doing it for, you know, individual reasons, or, you know, whether that's vanity or athletic performance or being able to, you know, do whatever, you know. That's where it gets really interesting to me, because once things are out there and we know when things go, how things can, whether it's the drug trade or, you know, things that kind of go, go black market, it's very difficult to control. Almost impossible, you might say.
Well, with body hacking, we tend to discuss technology. So it's not necessarily like, it was a movie called Pretty Little Things, and it was really fascinating because there was like a black market in a French hotel where individuals would come in and have their kidneys removed. And as you know, you can live with one kidney, but this took advantage of a sector of society that was vulnerable.
Right.
They were vulnerable to a point, or they were to a point in their lives that they felt that they would go without a vital organ in order to satisfy some type of need that they had in their lives.
Yes.
So there can be, we really do have to be honest in the discussion of whether we would then have a super society of those who have the ability to access them. Versus those who are not privy to it. So if there will be some type of caste system, whether there would be eugenics interjected into this. But I would like to think that technologies that we've primarily have really trumpeted, we hope in time that those will help the community at large. But at this point, these are things that are not happening in hospitals. They're not happening in doctors' offices. They're happening in people's homes, in tattoo parlors. And so unless you're playing Dungeons and Dragons with your friends and putting sensors, you probably wouldn't know that Friday night at 9, they're going to be putting sensors, because it's within that network of people who are aware that they're going to do that. But I think it's a really fine point as far as going back to that societal risk, because from a medical or health perspective, I do believe that we need to remember that we are connected. And so no matter what happens with that individual and how they may frame it as individual, it's affecting their families. It can then affect their communities. I know a very long time ago, a time that I would rather not repeat, I very unsuccessfully sold life insurance. Okay? Very unsuccessfully sold life insurance. Right. And we're looking at the writers and the things that would, negate the life insurance policy was like skydiving and these things were deemed to be risk-taking. There could be a point. Now they're going to have body hacking. You know, it's like, if this person hacks into their body and, you know, something adverse happens, will that family not be able to collect the life insurance? Because, you know, it's going to bleed into our social fabric. We're just not aware. And perhaps with our documentary, people will become more aware that it will touch their lives. It's just how quickly it'll touch their lives. I can't say. It may not be their life, but it'll be the life of their offspring. It'll be the life of future generations, but it's coming.
Change is coming. Yeah, it certainly is.
Change is coming in the wind. It really is.
You know, what was interesting to me when you mentioned skydiving there, and life insurance, one of my former guests was Kate Sukel, who wrote a book called The Art of Risk. And she interviewed a lot of skydivers and base jumpers and people that have done these sort of, you know, quote unquote, extreme things, risky things. And and I've also had conversations with, you know, with people who've done some really cool, but also what one might call extreme things. And one of the things that seems to come out with these conversations, people who do this successfully at any rate, is that they don't see some of these things as risky. Not because they have a different brain wiring or anything else necessarily, but because they practice and they dial in just about everything that you could think of when they're preparing to do some of these activities. I think we're talking about the people who've done this stuff successfully. And that's a way, you know, obviously of reducing risk, sort of repeated practice and thinking things through, and so they don't see those activities as risky. Whereas, you know, I think you don't know what's going on with people who are sort of body hacking, and. So I guess the question is, what are their own individual risk practices, right? So if somebody
yeah, that'd be a fascinating psychological study.
Yes.
Is this particular population more prone to risk taking? And another from a systems or networks science point of view, is whether these clusters or these cliques. And cliques are very tight networks of individuals who tend to percolate the same behaviors or the same ideas, and they're pretty resistant to outsiders infiltrating. These will be individuals who will be in very strong cliques.
Right.
They most likely are not going to be associating or disclosing this behavior to those who find that behavior to be abhorrent. They're not going to do that. They need a community that is going to be supportive of the behavior. And those individuals by that nature would be able to kind of bolster their confidence as far as risk. Like, hey man, I just inserted this. Man, you see, I'm cool. You do it too. Mm-hmm. And it is that kind of, and I've never hacked, but I could just really see how this could be possibly this kind of intoxicating camaraderie that they are innovating. They see all of them being brought together as radically innovating.
Yeah.
And I would say it has to be very intoxicating for them.
Yeah. I can definitely see that. I can also, like, I'm just thinking about people that are into, if you compare it to a hobby, right? So you have these communities about, like, I'm into cycling, and you know, you there are discussion forums and groups about, well, I just try to do this with my bike, and you know that, you know, this didn't work, or I've ruined this or whatever, and say, oh well, the reason why is because you didn't do this, or you should use this product instead of that product. And you get these like knowledge networks of what works and what doesn't work, but at the same time, I can tell you, I've screwed up stuff on my bike by experimenting, and that, you know, while that stuff is available, you know,
that's not inexpensive. My husband was a road cyclist, and he used to do criterions,
right?
And so I know about the Orbeas and, you know, Bianchi bikes and all of that.
Yes.
That is
not an inexpensive sport.
No.
And so, yes, so they will, there's only so much trial and error that you will be able to accept because there is a monetary loss.
That's right.
And there's also a loss to you physically and socially if you're not on your bike. You need to be on your bike.
Yeah.
Because that's a part of who you are. These individuals who are, you know, transforming their bodies, they're walking around with this transformation. Mm-hmm. So they're looking at it every day. They are hopefully receiving some benefit from that technology. But for them, the payoff is still unknown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're really willing to take that jump. And with the hopes that there will be a spectacular payoff in the end.
Right.
But we don't know if that's going to happen.
Yeah.
I don't wish ill on anyone, but there is just there is so much uncertainty that goes that would have to be accepted in order to move in this direction. And then risk is something that we're able to calculate. We're discerning our risk based on statistics and data that we are concatenating, putting together. But uncertainty, no idea. It's like that big question mark out there.
Yes.
And you just pray that things do not blow up. And I see transhumanism and body hacking as in that uncertainty.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, because people, you know, when they calculate risk, you know, it's a lot easier when you have historical data that kind of says, you know, this demographic or population or, you know, whatever the probabilities you can calculate
it can't
all
be,
that.
It can't be actuarial.
No.
At this point, we cannot do that with the body hacking.
No. And even like, you know, Michelle, like in finance, right? People try to calculate risk in finance because we have like hundreds of years of data of stock market movements, for example. And, you know, people try to famously predict what might happen with a particular stock because of, you know, all this historical data that we have, but we do not have enough historical data to predict anything about, you know, the stock market with a high degree of certainty at all. So, you know, how much more when we're talking about the human body, I'm very much in your camp that this all represents uncertainty versus risk.
Well, I'm glad we agree. I am certainly glad that we agree. And so
but there are ways to manage uncertainty.
You can help me. Yes, there are things that you do to try to harness or manage that uncertainty.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But this community does not have the mechanisms that most of us would go to in order to assure their health and well-being. They're out there going outside of the medical system.
Hmm.
Now, they may end up in the medical system at some point. I just wrote a blog for, it's called Impact Ethics. I'm pretty excited about it. And it is a call to medical professionals saying, you really need to pay attention to what is happening with this particular movement.
Mm-hmm.
Because medicine and training of clinicians is based on a very didactic approach to knowing how the body works, how systems are connected. This connects to this, which connects to this. There's no variation. If there's a variation, that's illness or disease, and then you try to eradicate it. We're going to have individuals who, on their own, have hacked themselves. And they will start being presented into the traditional medical establishment. Perhaps they are in need of other care that has nothing to do with that hack. And then the medical professors were like, I didn't learn this in medical school. Now they have changed our system. And so how am I going to deal with this change in the system? It's a fascinating topic.
It is,
I'm so excited about talking about
it's super exciting.
Goodness.
Yeah, no, it's super exciting. And we, you know, I do want to wrap it up soon, but I mean, it's, what would be interesting to hear is, you know, when people, on the first hand, on one hand, I have some cognitive dissonance around this because I think about risk and uncertainty and, you know, all of this stuff. At the same time, part of me kind of admires some of that community because I like innovators and I like, you know, this is how progress can be made and so on. So it's very interesting. But it would be interesting to also, you know, as people who, you know, get into the failed experiments, as you describe, people that move into the, have to get some care at the end of some experiments, whether or not they feel regret or disappointment, whether it's, you know, disappointment I characterize as, well, that didn't work out. I knew there was a risk. I tried this, but it didn't work out. And regret is like, this is, you know, it's going to change my life. I'll be regretting this for the rest of my life. I wish this didn't happen.
It's not like getting a really bad tattoo.
Right.
You could probably, hopefully you have it somewhere that you can cover it up, but there is tattoo removal. You can try to get another tattoo that overlays that.
Yeah.
This is radically modifying an element of a person's body.
Yes.
That body is life. It is living.
Yes. Yes.
That is what life is. It is the function of the body. And if it's radically being changed, then it's going to be fascinating to see, you know, what human will be and what the capabilities will be to push human farther. And whether transhumanism holds that key.
Yeah, it's very much watch this space is I think one of the overall messages wherever you fall in that whole spectrum. I think that we need to be having these conversations because this is going to come at us. Yeah, it is already coming at us very quickly, but before we know it, the technology is going to force those conversations whether we like it or not. So we better start now. Michelle, this has been fascinating. I think we covered a lot of ground. But were there other things that we missed or that you wanted to mention, or maybe something about the documentary itself that you're working on?
Yes. Well, the documentary, the working title is Transhuman, a Documentary. You are able to follow us on Twitter. You're also able to follow us on Facebook. And I will send in all of that information with all of our handles. If individuals are interested in my particular scholarship, I have a brand new spanking new website, which I think is really much better than the last. But it's M. Battle Fisher, M-B-A-T-T-L-E, Fisher, F-I-S-H-E-R.com. As I evolve, as my scholarship evolves, I just love individuals to give comment. Because a lot of what I write, it's coming from these very, very nutrient-rich discussions with individuals who are pushing, they're pushing my understanding of my boundaries. And I do work in the health arena, but you know, transhumanism is calling me a little bit too. So I may stay in this world a little longer than I might have anticipated. I never thought I would enter in this, but I think it was a natural progression from my previous work. So
well, I think I think you add quite a lot of value to the conversation, and I think it's, you know, as we said, it's an important one, and we need to, the thing about systems, we need to think about that uncertainty and unintended consequences and how things are linked together and all of that stuff, because if we take a very, you know, sort of narrow and reductionist approach to trying to quote unquote fix things through technology, then we will be, as they say here in the UK, we'll be missing a trick.
Ah, I'm going to remember that one. Missing a trick.
Yeah.
You have to get me more of those British,
right. British, Britishisms.
A Canadian, yes, a Canadian giving me the British cultural lessons. Teach me the vernacular.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think as an aside, you know, missing a trick is kind of not getting it quite right, but it actually could, you know, because Brits are very subtle, and North Americans are very direct, Americans in particular. And if you say that to, like, if you're having a meeting here in the UK about some sort of project or something, and you say, you know, I think we're missing a trick here, or we've missed a trick here, that's very damning. It means we're kind of really screwed it up. Whereas if you said that in a North American context, it would be like, okay, well, we'll just carry on. You know? So the cultures are different. Even though the same language is spoken here as it is in North America, you have to remember that. But yeah, missing a trick is good expression. this has been great. So if there's nothing, you know, I nothing else, then I wish you all the best with the all of the work and the documentary. And
let's stay very much in touch. My hope after the documentary is to write a book based on what I've learned from the documentary and, you know, interview more experts in the field. So
very cool.
I said, this might be a new journey.
It's always a journey, but this that sounds
Thank
great.
Thank you.
Fabulous. Thank you so much, Michelle. All the best.
It's been a blessing, and enjoy your cycling. Don't mess up your frame. That's horrible.
Yeah. Mess up the parts, not the frame. Don't crack your frame. Absolutely. All right. Bye for now.
Thank you.
So super interesting, right? Transhumanism is coming, so we need to be ready. Check out Michelle and her work. All the links are in the show notes. And before we go, just an announcement. I've got a couple of talks coming up in London on embracing risk. The first is an evening talk on July the 24th, and the second is a breakfast conversation on July the 28th. Links are in the show notes. If you want to continue the conversation or reach out to me in any way, you can drop me a note. allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to do that. And you can subscribe to the show in a number of ways on allthingsrisk.co.uk. If you want to know more about how to get the show on your iPhone or your Android phone or whatever app you like to use, you can check that out there. That is it. The next full episode will be up in 2 weeks' time. We might have an in-between episode next week, however. So in the interim, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.